Roll the tape.
This podcast is protected by copyright and not for broadcast. See rsn.net.au for more details.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to Talking Horses. On this week's program, we feature our new regular segment, Horse Bites. Swettenham Stud's Brian Gorman will join us to discuss the workings of a major stud farm operation and provide some handy tips on how breeding novices can secure themselves a good deal. We also find out how Group 1 winning sprinter and freshman sire Rebel Dane is settling into his new environs. We also talk horses, quite literally, with one of the icons of Australian equestrian, Barry Roycroft. Barry is one of the country's most decorated riders and hails, of course, from the sport's most famous family here in Australia. This week he was inducted into the Equestrian Victoria Hall of Fame. Barry, as is his usual style, has plenty to say and is well worth listening to. But first, we catch up with Sun Studs' Phil Marshall as one of Victoria's biggest farms prepares for the busy spring. And there's plenty of talk about the flashy chestnut Palantino, who has joined their roster at Kerry.
This podcast is brought to you by rsn.net.au.
Welcome back to the program. Sun Stud looking forward to the first season for Palantino this year. He was retired to Sun Stud earlier this year after a career that included victories in the Group 1 Australian Guineas and the Group 1 Mackayby Divas Stakes. He's the only horse, apart from the legendary Zabil, to achieve the double. And he certainly caught the imagination of broodmare owners throughout Australia. Phil Marshall joins us from Sun Stud. Hi, Phil.
Hey, Joe. How are you?
I'm very well, thanks. Must be looking forward to seeing what this flashy chestnut can do at stud. How's he settled into his new life?
He's settled in remarkably well. I mean, he settled in from day one, pretty much. We did a few stallion parades only a few weeks after he ran into Doncaster, and people couldn't believe how much he'd let down in that short space of time. And he already looks like he's done a season at stud. He looks fantastic.
He was a great racehorse, wasn't he? As I alluded to at the top of our interview, his wins in the Group 1 Australian Guineas and Mackayby Divas Stakes, outstanding. And he's the only other horse outside of Zabil to have achieved that rare feat.
Yeah, it's some stud, isn't it? I mean, it's just incredible that there's only been one other horse to do it, and it's been the almighty Zabil. If he could be half the horse Zabil has been, then we're going to be absolutely wrapped in him. But astonishing racehorse. I think what really made him such a real weapon was that he had such a good turn of foot. The way he put them away in those two races, and then also when he backed it up in the Blamey, that turn of foot was just sublime.
Some great mares, not surprisingly, are lining up to visit him this stud. And one of those is one of your own brood mares at Sun Stud, and that's Pretty Perfect.
Oh, it's actually Pretty Flamingo.
The half-sister.
Yes, half-sister.
To Pretty Perfect.
Yes. Yeah, no, look, that's an incredible family being out of Milanova. And it was good to see that another one of the half-siblings topped the July sale in Newmarket the other day at 330,000 guineas, which I think broke a record for that sale. So it's certainly a family that people want all around the world.
What other mares of such high note are likely to visit him this season?
There's a few. So we'll be sending him several mares and several of our better mares too. Of the clients' mares, probably the two of note, we've got the group-winning mare, Avienna, and also a mare called Shabtis, who is her first foal is a group winner, and she had a written tycoon sell this year at Easter for, I think it was about 525,000. So she clearly throws nice types. So he's getting a really good book first season. We're going to limit him to around about 120, 125, and he won't be long before he gets to that number.
Okay. Well, that's good news. And what about the rest of your rather large roster? What's the interest been like in them?
The interest has been very good this year, Joe. Probably the surprise package, or some may not think so, but fourth season sire Fighting Sun, just off the back of how his weanlings and yearlings sold this year, he's been incredibly popular. you know, kind of surprised me a little bit, given that he's fourth season. People tend to back off them a little bit. But they've you know, breeders have clearly just loved to see what they've seen at the sales, you know, what they've made as weanlings and yearlings over the last, you know, 6, 7 or 8 months. It's been incredible, and a lot of the key faces are breeding back to him again this year.
Well, that's good, isn't it? Yeah, it was a great story with the weanling that sold, was put forward by Tammy Notman, who we actually interviewed on the show. The evolvement of that particular Fighting Sun colt that they sold so well, from foal to weanling, was really impressive. And to go on and get that sort of price, which was one of the records for Victoria, was a great effort.
Yeah, it was. It was the record for the Vobis sale, and he was a magnificent colt. Rodney and Tammy had done a great job with him, and he deserved to bring that kind of money. He was a lovely, athletic, good balance, lovely walking colt. Look, he looked like he might be able to run a bit early too. So, fingers crossed, we get to see a few of these Fighting Suns before Christmas.
Not long till the breeding season begins. Our preparations must be in full swing at Sun Stud at the moment, in readiness.
Yeah, so everything's getting ready now. So, you know, it comes around so quickly. We've got several mares now that are getting ready. Some of our early foalers that are due early August, so they'll be coming in under lights and getting monitored, you know, overnight. We've got mares. A few mares heading to the Hunter that have gone already, and things are in full swing. I've just come back from Queensland, where we had our open day for the stallions up there on Sunday, which was a really, really good day, and we're gearing up for our open day in Victoria when it gets a little bit warmer, which is going to be on the 18th of August.
Must be a bit of a shock to the system, Phil, to come from Queensland back to the winter at Sun Stud. It can get pretty cold up there.
Yeah, well, I'm not back there yet, Joe. I'm in Sydney at the moment, so I'm trying to leave off the cold for as long as
prolong. I don't blame you. Before we know it, spring will be in the air again.
Yeah, and we can watch some fantastic racing again, and hopefully a few of our boys get a few nice winners during the spring.
Thanks for joining us, Phil, and good to hear that the take-up rate for Palantino, not surprisingly, has been strong so far.
Thanks, Joe.
This podcast is brought to you by rsn.net.au.
Joining us for this week's edition of Horse Bites is Swettenham Stud's General Manager, Brian Gorman. Good morning.
Good morning, Joe. How are you?
Very well. How have you been faring in the winter?
It has been very, very chilly, with a lot of frost and not a lot of rain, but it's nice to see a real winter again.
Is that a good thing?
I think so. From a sort of seasonal point of view, the frosts do kill a lot of bugs and bits and pieces that are lying dormant in the soil.
Be a few less European wasps hovering around in the summer then.
Exactly.
Wonder how I knew that. Now, you have two freshman stallions standing this season. We discussed M. Shawish last week on the program with Brad Weisbord and Adam Sangster. How is Rebel Dane settling in for his first season?
Joe, Rebel Dane's thriving. We're thrilled with the way he's let down and the way that he's settled in. He just loves getting out into his stallion paddock and into a familiar surrounding. He's an absolute demon for finding any sort of muddy patch and rolling quite contentedly in that, regardless of the weather. But he has a fantastic attitude. He's a real gentleman to handle. And he pays attention to everything that's going on around him. It's really interesting to watch him taking it all in.
What's his level of popularity been like? Some of his better performances in his career were in Victoria, so already his profile is quite high in the state.
Oh, definitely. And he's the type of horse that will appeal to both people that want to breed to race and from a sales perspective. He's a lovely type of animal, and the inquiry level is, you know, really satisfactory at this stage.
How has he let down so far?
Look, it's quite surprising when he arrived, and obviously he was at the top of his game and fit as a greyhound. So you sort of look at them and you think, oh, this is going to take ages. But over the last couple of seasons, we've used the same sort of formula with the likes of Puissance de Lune and Trust and August, and we've sort of taken the approach that we want them to really be appealing to the clients when they see them for the first time, and not sort of standing back and saying, oh, he'll be a different horse in 12 months. This horse is actually, you know, right on par. He's letting down beautifully, and you can really see what he's going to develop into.
So, Brian, with freshman stallions, can you give us some insight into how you educate them for their new role and prepare them for what they have to do in the breeding barn?
It's quite interesting, Joe. Every horse is different, and obviously natural instinct sort of plays a large part of it. It's something that you definitely can't force the horses to, you know, to just stroll into the breeding shed like they've been there before and serve the mare. Quite often it's very, very daunting for them. So there's a lot of time and patience that have to be put into it for them to get their confidence. They spend their whole life being told, don't look at the fillies, don't look at the fillies, and then suddenly it's, please, look at the fillies, you can do whatever you want.
So, and how do you think Rebel Dane's going to take to his new role in life?
Well, as I said, he pays so much attention to everything going on around him, and he knows exactly that the mares are living over those hedges. So I would hope that it'll all be very, very straightforward.
So when potential clients, Brian, are looking at freshman stallions, what in particular should they keep in mind?
I find this interesting every year with clients looking at freshman horses, that they're sort of trained to look at the seasoned stallions, and then they see a freshman horse and they, he's not quite there. He's not there because he's come from full training. Usually they have enough of the spell that they're starting to let down, but they need to overlook, you know, the racing physique and the muscular sort of shadows that are there, and look beyond that. A lot of people have only seen these horses in the mounting yard or seeing them at studs for the first time, and a lot of people can be put off by it because they're not used to seeing stallions that are, you know, are coming out that are still a little bit tight. So if any sort of advice, you know, like that with freshman horses, is you've got to look beyond what you're seeing at the moment because it's all in front of them.
And sometimes it's more challenging with certain horses to get them to let down. Some take longer than others.
Well, no doubt we'll see it, that there'll be a sudden retirement to stud, you know, late in the off-season, and you're trying to make up for lost time. Certainly with the shuttle horses, it all depends on how they've travelled, and, you know, and first impressions are so important that that's, you know, the point that I'm making, that you've got to give them the benefit of the doubt a lot of times.
Now, Swettenham Stud is more than just a stallion station. You offer a lot of other services. Can you give us some insight into the role that you play in the industry these days in Victoria, and especially in conjunction with other smaller operations?
Sure. Look, I think a lot of people sort of can just see us with our stallions and our stallion roster. They're aware that, you know, we're a major vendor of yearlings. But probably what isn't as well known is that, you know, we offer a full womb to the tomb sort of package that we offer full adjustment right across the board of ages. We also, you know, with our breeding plan, we have our own resident vet, Dr. John Hurley, who is, you know, renowned for his reproductive work. So there's a whole package of what we can offer out there to the clients. And in conjunction with the other smaller farms, you know, the walk-on farms, they play a huge part in what we do by offering a different sort of service to different clients. A lot of clients like the smaller, you know, more personal approach. So we work very closely with them throughout the breeding season with walk-ons from there, and in a lot of cases offer reciprocal services that if they don't you know, necessarily have a draft of yearlings going to here or there. Quite often, Swettenham will act as agent for them.
Now, Swettenham is one of the largest and most high-profile thoroughbred studs in Australia. For novice breeders to approach an operation like yours, it can be very daunting. Do you have any advice for people that are in that position?
Certainly. It's always really interesting when the phone call comes through and it's a new breeder and they're sort of not quite sure how they should approach, you know, talking about a nomination or perhaps making an offer on a nomination. Look, the advice that I would give them is don't be afraid to make an offer. The worst that you can do is be told, no, that's not enough. But also ask them what can the studs do for them as far as packaging together deals or, you know, payment terms or deal with it as any other sort of investment and really get involved in it and not be put off by, you know, what is advertised.
And do you like to encourage your clients to come out to the farm and have a good look around and get a better understanding of how these operations look and function?
Oh, definitely. And Adam Sangster has an open gate policy that, you know, anyone's welcome. Certainly by getting in touch with us and letting us know that when and where they would like to visit the farm, it's with our open days, which are on the 20th and 27th and then the 3rd of September. We love seeing people and we love showing our product.
Mm. So if anyone's interested in attending one of those days, either on the 20th or the 3rd of September, the 27th I see is by appointment only, what should they do?
Please just contact the office or you can go to our website and you'll be able to just click on the invitation or alternatively contact either myself or Rachel Ritchie and we'll be able to help you from there.
I strongly suggest our listeners do take the opportunity to get out to Swettenham and have a look. It's one of the most magnificent thoroughbred nurseries in Australia and always a very friendly and welcoming experience when you get there. Brian, thanks for joining us this week to give us your insight on horse bites.
Thanks, Jo.
The Equestrian Victoria Sport Achievement Awards and Hall of Fame Night was conducted during this past week and Barry Roycroft was deservedly inducted into the Equestrian Victoria Hall of Fame and he's our special guest on the program this week. Hi, Barry.
G'day, Joe. How are you going?
I'm very well. Congratulations on a truly deserved accolade.
Thank you very much.
Your name is so synonymous with Australian equestrian, hailing from the famous Roycroft family, of course, a resident of Victoria. You've had an incredible life and career with horses. You've ridden in three Olympic Games in various disciplines as show jumping and eventing, and nowadays enjoying farm life.
Yep. Oh, I've been very fortunate.
Yeah, and you're out feeding some cattle right now.
Yep, I'm feeding my cows and calves. The calves are looking brilliant this year.
Are they? Good.
Yep.
So you're down in the Western Districts, is that right?
Yep, I live in Camperdown and I've got my farm is at Glenormiston where we live. I bought this block of land in 1966 after I came back from Europe. And, I farmed and lived here and this is where I produce most of my horses.
Mm. So you still got a few horses poking around these days?
No, I've only got two horses on the place. I actually haven't got a horse I can ride right at the moment.
Ah. But you still ride when you can?
I haven't been on a horse for about 11 months.
Oh, right, okay. For a particular reason?
Yeah, I was breaking in a young horse and she put the wind up me, so... And for the first time in my life, I felt a little insecure on a horse. The ground is very hard when you get older because I'm 73 now and I don't feel like hitting it.
Mm, fair enough. Do you think you'll ever ride again or if you do, it'll be on a quieter prospect?
Yes, I hope to get a horse just to poke around on. But I must admit that I never really just rode a horse to have a ride. I was a very competitive type person. I always wanted to be doing something with my horses rather than just riding down the road.
Yeah, fair enough. And you've had an incredible career in the saddle, Barry, stemming back to a very young age and a lot of Olympic experience.
Yes, well, I learned to ride because I had to ride to school. So obviously, I think you start school between 5 or 6. So we rode Welsh Mountain ponies to school. That's myself and my brothers. 3 miles there and 3 miles back, we had the fastest and fittest ponies in the West. But unfortunately, once we got them quiet, my parents would sell them on and we'd have to start again. So we threw a lot of ponies.
Yeah. And eventually that journey took you to Olympic standards. And interestingly, you competed at that level in two disciplines, show jumping and also eventing.
Yep. Well, I started out, well, we used to always show jump the horses before they went eventing. And I rode in my first three-day event basically the day I turned 17, and that was in Sydney in 1961. I ran second in that event, and then that seemed to be a bit of a precedent because I finished up only ever winning one three-day event, but I ran second 14 times. So the old
forever the bridesmaid.
Never give up. try again, yes.
Yeah. Well, that determination took you a long way, didn't it?
I had some amazing journeys starting off as a very young fellow. I was very fortunate to have three brilliant mentors in my development years. That was Colin Kelly from Barwidgee here in the Western District, Sir Alec Creswick, who was chairman of Equestrian Australia, chairman of Equestrian Victoria at the time, who we got a lot of horses off his Riverina stations, and my father, of course. And they instilled into me at a very young age, he said, they used to say, well, Colin and Sir Alec would say, remember, son, to put back into the sport what you get out of it. And I hope I've done that.
Well, you have, because beyond your riding, you've actually contributed a huge amount in the administrative side of the sport, and mainly as a coach. Barry, you from 1990 to 2004 were the National Young Rider Coach and helped get three successful Trans-Tasman Young Rider eventing teams over the line.
Yes, we had a lot of success as the coaching. I mean, like, in days gone by, and I mean, and as I said the other night to the youngsters at the awards night, you have to learn from history to move forward. And we had a very, very good development system here in Australia in the 90s and early 2000s. And EA seems to have lost their way a little bit. When my brother moved out of his post, things haven't been as forward-thinking as they used to be. Fortunately, here in Victoria, we still have a very good squad system, which I have to say I was instrumental in starting in the late 80s. But, I've had a great time. I was on the Victorian Equestrian Federation board for 35 years or thereabouts. Mm. And, so as well as competing, I was on the administrative side. I meant to mention the other night that when the initial three-day events were held at Oaklands, some of our competitors, like Bill Roycroft and Ernie Barker and co, they used to go to the venue and actually help build the course before they rode it.
That's dedication, and that's what the sport is still today, very reliant on people volunteering their time a lot.
That's exactly right, but unfortunately, culture seems to be changing to a degree, and a lot of our younger riders now expect the competition to be put on for them rather than help put the competition on.
And what are your views on the talent standards of young riders, not just in Victoria but across Australia at the moment? Is the future bright for us at Olympic level, do you think?
Well, I hope so. But I've got to say, apart from a few individuals, the base standard of our riding is nowhere near as good as it used to be.
Why do you think that?
Well, because in the old days, and you shouldn't talk about the old days, but in the old days, you had to do stuff. Remember, when our eventing, in the eventing scene, when it started, the lowest level, you had to be able to jump 3'6". I didn't go to the first Interbranch Pony Club. I went to the second one, which was held on the Mornington Peninsula. Then there was 150 competitors competing at 1.10 metre, as it is today. Now, when you go to the interbranch, they're flat out getting 30 or 40 in the competition. You need to ask yourself why. I mean, as we've dumbed the sport down with lower and lower grades, skills not required. All you need to be able to do is face the horse of the fence and sit. And unfortunately, a lot of our professional coaches coach for the next lesson rather than advancing their riders.
And that's a view that's shared internationally by some of the most acclaimed riders. It was very interesting a couple of weeks ago, Barry, I listened to a podcast involving a top American show jumping rider and now coach, and she was very vocal about her concerns around how young riders are being brought through the ranks and that these days, like you say, it's a little bit too easy for them, and many people are now buying their way to success by getting ready-made horses and putting young riders on them rather than the riders having to do the hard yards, like ride to school every day on a pony.
Yeah, that's true. Well, I spent a year in America in 1976, and in America it was already happening then. I mean, at that stage, you could actually buy yourself onto an American Olympic team if you bought the right horse and so forth. And of course, in America, they started out the amateur rider system to allow the ordinary person, if they had enough money, because it's a very expensive sport to participate in America. Here in Australia, we're so lucky that the average person can still ride a horse. But, I mean, if you look at the top levels of our sport now, we talk Olympic Games and World Games and so forth, money's actually wrecked show jumping and dressage. Eventing is actually a sport where the average person can still excel at the three basic disciplines of riding, dressage, show jumping and cross-country.
And at the moment, Barry, Australia is represented by some fantastic riders, particularly in the eventing discipline, the likes of Shane Rose, who finished third at Arkin last weekend in the individual standings, and, of course, the Australian team finished second to the powerful German contingent, but also Chris Burton, who's a superb rider, and more recently a young rider from Victoria, Katja Wayman, making her way to the Northern Hemisphere to pursue her career. She's a hard worker. She's had to even breed her own horses to get to that standard.
Yeah, Katja's a terrific example of someone that's actually come through and into the sport the old way, having to do it hard, having to produce your own horses, having to break the horses in, educate the horses and so forth. And I hope Katja has success on the huge amount of investment she's put in going to Europe.
And in the show jumping scene,
winner for our young event rider too at the Victorian Awards.
And not surprisingly, she's a great rider, and let's hope that she does continue to enjoy success. Of course, it was her first Arkin team at the weekend, so to place second was a great effort.
That's right. I mean, in 1965, I actually rode at Arkin, but in show jumping.
Yeah. It's a great show, isn't it?
It's an amazing show. Absolutely.
What's your fondest moment in the saddle, Barry? You've had many highlights, but is there one that really stands out?
Well, I've got to say that might sound a bit stupid, but my greatest joy out of all my riding was actually getting a young horse to be able to do something. We used to get lots of horses off the racetracks and so forth, and I'd set myself little goals, and often it would be just to be able to get an ex-racehorse to canter on each lead and canter on that lead when you asked it for it, to win a first ribbon with the horse or to jump a clean round, all those little goals. They actually stick in my mind a little bit more than maybe the Olympic Games and so forth. Remember, when you go to the Olympic Games, there's an enormous amount of pressure, and you're expected to do as well as you can, and when you don't do quite as well as you would have liked, there's that instant disappointment. But it's the real reward comes when you come home or when you're speaking to someone, they remind you of the fact that to get to those World Games or Olympic Games, you had to have been one of the best in your own country. But there's lots and lots of highlights. I mean, getting picked for my first Games, I had a major disappointment when I missed out on Inter-Pacific Pony Club. I was named as the fourth reserve, for Victoria, I might add. And 3 days later, I was picked in the Australian Olympic team. So wow. It just goes to show you how hard it is to get into a pony club team.
Gee whiz, that's a different level compared to pony club riding at the Olympics, and to be selected for that, but that must have been an enormous thrill. And what about a particular horse, Barry, that stands out in your memory bank?
Well, I've been fortunate enough to have five what you would call absolute champion horses. My first one was Janowie. He was bred by Sir Alec Krizik. He was the most amazing horse. He'd been to the Olympic Games. He'd won major international competitions in England and Ireland. He won the Horse and Hound Cup at White City in London. He ran second in the Aga Khan Cup in Dublin. And he was sold just before he turned eight. Now, if that horse could have been brought back to Australia, he could have gone to two more Olympic Games. He actually finished going to the Munich Games as David Broome's reserve horse. Then I had the Hi-Fi that should have gone to the Olympic Games. Unfortunately, the 1972 team, I was picked to go to Munich, but Kevin Bacon's horse went wrong, and so the team didn't go, and that would have been Signet Rambler, Jeff Evans' horse from South Australia, who was a freak. Hi-Fi, who was also a freak. That team would have been very competitive. Then I had Four Corners, a magnificent grey horse that was the most clean show jumper I've ever had. Here in the Western District shows, he went for 3 years without knocking a rail down. And then, of course, Last Tango, who was my event horse, he was just a machine. Fantastic horse. He advanced, evented for 10 years and finished up with a total penalty of 120 faults. Mm. One fall and three stops. So I've been very lucky. And, of course, I've had a lot of ordinary horses as well. It's when you get a good one, you really appreciate it.
Yeah, yeah. And your love of the horse, Barry. Now, obviously, you were born into a horsey life with your father, Bill, obviously. But what is it about the horse for you that motivates you, that inspires you and makes you so passionate? Because you can hear that tone in your voice that you just love the sport and you love the animal.
Well, the greatest thing about the horse is that every horse is an individual. And I think that part of having a success on the horses was I rode every horse as an individual, and every horse had its own characteristics. It's amazing, like my parents used to breed a lot of horses, 14 or 15 horses a year, most of them by the stallion we had called Stanisław, who actually won 22 races. But he produced a number of horses, went to the Olympic Games. But every horse had their own characteristics. They used to talk to you in different ways. I mean, here I was very lucky. I only had to walk 75 metres from the house to the stable, and I must admit I only had stables after I'd already been to two Olympic Games. Most of the horses were produced out of shelters and 44-gallon drums and rails and all basic stuff. In the winter, we used to ride on the roads just so you could keep them above ground and all that sort of stuff. But every horse had its own characteristics. Initially, I used to have to ride anything because I couldn't afford to not, mainly horses that were given to me off the track and that sort of stuff. Mm. But further into my career, if I didn't like the horse, I didn't ride it. Simple as that.
Yeah. A waste of time, I guess. And so have you had much to do with horse racing? Many of our listeners on this program are involved in the thoroughbred racing and breeding industry. What's been your experience in it? Have you ever owned a racehorse or prepared one?
My parents raced horses. I lost all my pocket money when I was a very young fella. We had a steeplechase that should have won the Warrnambool Grand Annual. Called Bernabaru. He was leading by six lengths over the last fence. And in those days, they used to finish up the straight the reverse way. The jockey pulled the inside rein to straighten the horse up the straight. He crossed his front legs and went arse overhead.
Oh.
And I lost all my pocket money, so I've had very few bets since. I've had a lot of pressure to train jump race horses. I go to the races once or twice a year. I love jump racing. I love going and watching the jump racing, particularly at Cheltenham in England. I follow the races religiously on Facebook and on television, but I haven't owned a racehorse. I'm actually considering getting into a syndicate to race, actually a standardbred, not a racehorse, which doesn't cost quite so much money, but I follow the breeding and all that sort of stuff, but no, I haven't actually raced a horse myself. I did ride over I rode in four hurdle races in England in 65 until we had a telegram back in those days from Sir Alec Krizik saying, under no circumstances is Roycroft to ride in races. Little did he realise that we used to get a quid to put a horse over, and a pound was a lot of money then, over four hurdles just in training.
Oh dear, what a great life you've had thus far, Barry, and so many great memories, not just here in Australia, but certainly internationally. And it's wonderful to hear that you're in good health and good spirit, and I hope you do invest in that racehorse and have a bit of luck.
Yeah, but I mean, in the last, since 2000, I've been working in Japan, and when you talk about racehorses, I'm fortunate enough, actually, in September, I go back to, and your racing people will know, I go and work for Katsumi Yoshida. Now, Katsumi Yoshida is one of the biggest private racehorse owners in the world. He has a stud at Northern Farm on Hokkaido that has between 800 and 900 brood mares. They have an annual sale where they sell about 550 weanlings and yearlings. He expects to win around about 1,000 races a year. He has run first and second in the Melbourne Cup. And the thoroughbreds there are just absolutely amazing. I go to two of his training centres, one at Tenai on the main island and Northern Farm in Hokkaido. And it's just a wonderful thing. And I've also been involved in a young rider exchange between Australia and Japan. We've had 41 Japanese riders here to Australia and 40 young riders from Australia to Japan. And I've been very proud of that.
Mm-hmm. Equestrian or racing-connected riders?
No. Equestrian riders backwards and forwards. When I go to Northern Farm and to Tenai, in the morning I teach equestrian riders, and in the afternoon I have track riders. Yoshida initially had me there to teach the track riders to ride the horses on the bit. The setup there is absolutely amazing. These guys, when they do fast work, up a 35-degree slope, at Northern Farm in a 1,200-metre covered gallop. They ride in a longish race stirrup length. And the moment they finish their fast work, the stirrups go down to a jump length. They take the horses into a menage and do circle work. Amazing. I saw 11 deep impact colts working in a 30-by-70 arena doing flying changes on the diagonal.
Wow.
And that's why, I mean, Deep Impact is the horse that took over from Sunday Silence. Your racehorse listeners will understand those things. Deep Impact is probably the best conformed horse I've ever seen in my life.
Incredible. That's why they're so good and they're hard to beat, especially when they bring their powerhouse horses down here for the Melbourne Cup, Barry.
Well, it's interesting. Fame Game that was out here, when he went back to Japan, the Yoshida setup didn't think he was good enough to run in the Japan Cup. So it gives you an idea of the standard of horse they have.
Yeah, exactly.
They're beautiful thoroughbreds. And I don't know why they don't use more of them in their equestrian world. Many, many of them finish up in the university equestrian clubs, which is very strong in Japan. The university equestrian clubs are a bit like pony club here. They don't have pony club in Japan.
Mm.
So the young Japanese, one of the few chances they get to ride is if they're at university and can get into the University Equestrian Club.
Well, Barry, it's wonderful to talk to you and hear your insights as well, especially into the Japanese thoroughbred racing and breeding scene. A real treat to be able to go up there every year and have a good look around. It's something I certainly aspire to do myself. And Barry, we look forward to hearing about your success as an owner. I know I keep digressing back to that, but I hope you can make amends for losing all your pocket money on that steeplechase many years ago.
Well, it's interesting. Last year we went to the races at Sapporo. They have 14 races on the program, 8 of them on dirt and 6 on grass. Coming to the last race, you can bet as little as 10 yen, which is like about 20 cents. And coming to the last race, I had a bet on every horse, and no matter what happened, I was going to finish in front for the day.
Wow.
Another interesting thing at the races there is that prior to each race, they actually show the weight of the horse. It's a bit like greyhound racing here. And so they show the difference in the weight between its last start and this start. And that's often a very good guide as to how they're going to run.
It is. It's always a good opportunity to assess the form that little bit better. We might have to get used to start tipping on the program, Barry.
I don't know about that. The other interesting thing, and our administrators here might like to listen to this one, it costs $1 to get into the races in Japan.
Mm.
And at this small meeting in Sapporo, there was about 30,000 people there. They take families, go along, they have picnics and so forth. It's very popular in Japan, racing.
Yeah. We could certainly take a leaf out of the book of some of those very successful racing jurisdictions around the world. Barry, thank you so much for joining us on Talking Horses. A real treat to catch up with you.
Thank you. Sometimes it's a bit hard to shut me up. I'm sorry.
That's all right. I could listen to you all day, as I'm sure our listeners could. That's Barry Roycroft, a global equestrian legend, recently inducted into the Equestrian Victoria Hall of Fame.
This podcast is brought to you by rsn.net.au.
Thanks for your company on Talking Horses this week. I hope you've enjoyed the program. Our special thanks to guests this week, Swetnam Stud's Brian Gorman, Phil Marshall from Sun Stud, and Barry Roycroft for sharing his amazing stories and insights. Until next time, take care. Bye for now.
This podcast was brought to you by rsn.net.au.